You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. In 2019, Chef Magnus Nilsson closed Faviken, his one-of-a-kind Michelin-starred restaurant in remote Sweden, a difficult decision as it was close to his heart and at the height of its success, ranking among the top restaurants in the world. Now he shares how Faviken became a world-class destination, how the industry it was part of has changed, and why he eventually elected to pursue new projects in his new book, Faviken, 4,015 Days Beginning to End. And today, Magnus Nilsson joins me on the podcast to discuss why he chose to write a book about a restaurant that's no longer open, what went into his decision to shutter Faviken for good, what he's up to next, and whether he thinks he might open another restaurant anytime soon. He talks about his reliance on fresh, local, seasonal ingredients, the difference between great produce and exceptional produce, and why he'd rather have an exceptional carrot than imported Kobe beef or foie gras any day. He speaks frankly about the lack of originality and surprise among chefs, how food bloggers, Instagram, and to some extent even diners themselves are ruining the dining experience, and what he calls the hypocrisy of sustainability in the restaurant business. Coming up with Chef Magnus Nilsson in just a moment. Magnus Nilsson is one of the world's most creative and celebrated chefs. His restaurant Faviken received 2 Michelin stars and was ranked among the 100 best restaurants in the world before closing its doors in 2019 at the height of its success. Now he writes about that incredible journey and his decision to leave the restaurant business at the peak of his game in a new book titled Faviken, 4,015 Days Beginning to End. Chef Magnus Nilsson, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, Magnus, can I still call you chef? What are the rules on that sort of thing? Is it like a military title where you get to keep it after you retire? How does that work?
I've actually never been particularly fond of that. And
Really?
I usually prefer people just calling me Magnus. But and that was also the case at the restaurant. But I think maybe we can consider it an honorary military title then.
Okay.
That you can keep it after you retire if you want to.
Okay. Well, hopefully you won't be retired forever. I'm hoping that you'll come back. I have to say, you're a pretty young guy to be retiring from the business. I think that you're only in your mid-30s, but I suppose that you got an early start. Somewhere I read that you cooked your first meal at age 3. Is that right?
They say I did. I mean, I don't remember it myself, but my parents claim that that's the case. I don't know if it was a very particularly successful meal, but I cooked something.
Okay. So this is sort of family lore that you cooked your first meal.
Exactly. But I do think it's actually true that I got an early start. And I think that's very common actually in hospitality that, I mean, you generally perhaps not go to university and things like that. Yeah. You will start after high school and then start working, which means that even if you're like me, 36, you actually already worked for more than 15 years.
Now, where did your love of cooking come from? Was there someone particular in your family?
I think that there is a combination. I mean, food has always been important in my family. Both my parents cook. My grandmother on my mother's side, she used to work as a cook in a nursing home. And on my father's side, she kind of ran the kitchen on the farm that they lived on. Mm. So food has always been like very present and considered something important.
Now, you know? Is it true that you originally wanted to be a marine biologist? And does that ever come in handy when you're deboning fish these days?
Yeah, you know, that's true amongst many other things that I've been wanting to become at one part or another in life so far. Yeah. But yeah, you know, I've always been very fascinated with like the sea and everything that lives in it.
Now, prior to opening your own restaurant, you were a sous chef, I believe, at L'Astrance and L'Arpège in France. What did you learn in those two kitchens?
I was actually never even a sous chef. I was just a cook there in both of those places. Okay. But I mean, I think that the most important part for me, because I left Sweden and moved to France when I was 19, mostly to go on holiday. And then I ended up, for various reasons, staying and working for, you know, quite a few years. Mm-hmm. And I think that the absolutely biggest takeaway from those years, and this sounds like a little bit weird, but it's actually that I learned to speak French as a person who lives in another country. It's a different thing. And then I think when you look at the cooking specifically with both of those restaurants, I mean, I learned tons of obviously useful technique and approaches to doing things and passion about food and hospitality and all of these things. But I think that perhaps the most defining thing for me that I learned, especially from L'Astrance, was actually excellence in produce, like what that actually really means. Mm-hmm. In a way that, I mean, I always thought that I worked with great produce in all the restaurants I worked also prior to that, but you know, there's always another level to discover. And I think that those two restaurants are at sort of the very pinnacle of what, how good it can be when it comes to produce.
Yeah, you talk in the book about the difference between great produce and exceptional produce. What makes for exceptional produce?
That's like the little bit that is hard to define like this. Mm-hmm. Like the part of something that you perceive with a product, a piece of vegetable or meat or fish or whatever it is, that you can't quantify from the beginning. At least this is my experience, you know, because a product can have all of the kind of technical qualities that you would be looking for it to be good or even great. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's just exceptional. And that's when something really speaks to you. And it's like, I don't know where it comes from. It's just there sometimes, and other times it's not.
Okay. So you know it when you see it or smell it or taste it.
Yeah.
I'm interested that you got such a young start, because you actually say in this book that most cooks are too young and inexperienced. And yet you worked in these kitchens in your early 20s and started your own restaurant in your mid 20s. Looking back, did you feel that you were too young to be opening a restaurant back then?
There are two ways of looking at that question, because technically, yes. And I wouldn't recommend anyone else to open a restaurant age 24, at least not that kind of restaurant with that level of ambition and, you know, everything that comes with that. Because I was, as a person then, definitely not mature enough to handle that responsibility with employees and things like that, you know. And I was definitely not good enough at the managerial side of running a business either. And it took me many years to learn both of those things in a good way. And that cost me a lot of stress and a lot of pain. It'll cost, you know, a lot of other people also like unnecessary stress and pain. But on the other hand, I also don't think that if I would have waited and opened the restaurant today, age 36, you know, my first restaurant, when I'm more mature as a human and know much more about how things function in society and life, I don't think it would have been the same restaurant. I owe the fact that Faviken became what it is to those circumstances that I happened to open when I was that young. So it is like, really, I can't recommend anyone to do it, but I also acknowledge the fact that this is the base of what I did, you know? Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because you, in the book, you discuss the fact that you had written a previous book, I think in 2012, about the restaurant. And when you look back at so many of the things you talk about in that book that were aspirational and they were kind of dreams that you wanted for the restaurant, and then to be able to go back in hindsight now and see what evolved, what didn't evolve, what you got that you wanted and what you didn't, and all that.
Yeah, no, it is. That is actually really weird. And I think I write about that somewhere in the book as well, that the first book, because that was commissioned in 2010 and it came out, like you said, in 2012. So, and Faviken, I came there in 2008. So essentially that book was about the restaurant that didn't quite yet exist. So it was, like you say, aspiration. It was like a declaration of a program for running this restaurant. Mm-hmm. And now the other book that comes out, it's about the restaurant that doesn't exist anymore.
Right. Let me ask you this. I don't know if this is a silly question, but how long does it take to really get good at the craft of cooking? Or can that be quantified? I don't know.
No, my conclusion is that it can't, but that repetition and, like, you know, the daily grind to learn a craft, to get it in your hands, to get past the point where the craft itself becomes a hindrance for, like, your vision of what you want to do, that there's no way around that. You have to put the time in. But I also don't quite buy this idea that you can quantify it, like the Malcolm Gladwell style of the 10,000 hours, right, or like, right, whatever sort of pop science-y way, yeah, of explaining that you can find. But there, yeah, is something to it that when it comes to craft, and obviously this is also like depends on your personal traits and your kind of the ability that you were born with to understand and do something with your hands, perhaps. But I mean, you need to put the hours in for sure.
After your time in France, you came back to Sweden and focused on becoming a wine writer. Why did you need a break from restaurants? Were you burnt out on cooking back then?
Yeah. No, I was. I don't think I was burnt out, but I was probably a bit disillusionized, because when I came back to Sweden, I had worked in these truly exceptional restaurants in France. I had seen like how good produce could be. I had seen, like, you know, the commitment from the customers in those restaurants. I had seen how much they could charge. I could see the resources they could pour into having lots of staff, and like all of these things that seemed then, this was in 2006 maybe, it seemed completely unachievable in Sweden. And and that really turned me off of the idea of even trying, I think.
You've said that part of the reason that you took a break from cooking was that you didn't think that you could source the same ingredients in Sweden that were as good as they were in France. And yet you went on to run a restaurant that became famous for relying in large part or almost entirely on locally sourced ingredients. How did you come to realize that everything you needed was really right there in your own backyard, so to speak?
I mean, it seems so dumb when I think about and talk about it today, but I mean, all of that produce was already there. And the only thing was that it wasn't considered restaurant produce, and it wasn't made available through a wholesale system or anything like that, which was the case in France. You can go to a great food market in France and you can buy wholesale of this exceptional produce if you have the money and the contacts. But in Sweden, that wasn't the case at the time, and it still isn't the case at the same level as in France, even if it's gotten better. And I just never then realized that all of the things that I grew up eating and that my family cooked, and the stuff that the neighbor grew, all of these things, they were actually like at that, you know, super peak level of quality. But I never saw it that way until I came into a position where I had to.
Well, nowadays, sourcing local ingredients has become a selling point for a lot of restaurants. It's almost part of their marketing. But when you opened Favakin in 2008, had the whole local, seasonal, farm-to-table movement really kicked off at that point?
Not like this sort of wave that we are in now. I mean, there were definitely restaurants who did that before Favakin, plenty of them. I mean, I think especially actually in the US, I mean, Alice Waters, for example, a great inspiration in that sense, like one generation before. But I think that type of experiential restaurant in the countryside with a very contemporary look on the food and a very contemporary way of looking at the food, that hadn't been done that way before, and definitely not by someone like me. And I, as I said, it was mostly a quality thing for the produce for me in the beginning, and that's what sort of got me on that track, that it was much easier to get like amazing quality beef if you could also speak to the guy that owned the cattle and have a dialogue and, you know, get to a point where you understood each other. And that applied to anything. And then I realized quite quickly that it was also an interesting thought experiment when it came to like the creative output of the restaurant, because it's a constraint, even though it's one that you've chosen to impose on yourself, to only work with produce from people you know and people locally. And constraints lead to, you know, new ideas of thinking, new ways of thinking and new ideas when it comes to what you want to produce, I think.
I mean, it's similar to the film business, where there are a million stories of filmmakers like Robert Rodriguez who, you know, had these wonderful innovative ideas because they had limited resources to work with. And, you know, he had a big action scene on a bus because he happened to have a friend who had a bus. You know? And so, and I wonder, when you're coming up with all of these delicious dishes, what percentage of it is your experience? How much of it is creativity? And how much of it is just random inspiration?
I think it's, for me, it's like, it took many years until I started to actually really think about my own creative process. And I think that was probably in like maybe 2015 or 2014, where I actually stumbled upon a book on like creative theory, started reading about this, understanding that there's like research on how the creative process in the human mind actually functions. And that is not what it appears, because it can appear as if it's magic, you know, that just things just happen.
Sure.
But that's not the case. You know, it's an actual subconscious process that's being fed with all of the things that you perceive as a human being. Every little experience and perception that you recorded is part of that process. So after that, it became much more clear to me that my approach was going to be to figuring out new things, just fill that sort of bank, that the toolbox, if you will, with as much as possible, and like trying to approach as many situations as unbiased as possible, which is actually so much more difficult than it sounds.
Sure.
But so important, because if you go into an experience or a situation already knowing what you're going to experience, or having already decided what it's going to be like, that's not going to be like something that you can build new creativity on. That's
right.
Going to be so tainted by your previous knowledge. And that was really interesting. And I kind of also came away with the conclusion that I'm actually much less creative than I thought myself, and much less creative than other people think. But I'm also good at, you know, turning my creative ideas into something. They don't stop at the ID stage, many of them. I actually get them to become a dish or something else. But I've also come across, like in this sort of research work, like so many people that are so much more creative than me, but of which many of them haven't been able to like create that framework for it to become something.
Well, let me ask you this. What would you say is the enemy of creativity in the restaurant business?
For me, it would be this thing that you are unable to continue collecting truly new experiences with an open mind. Like the day you stop filling your creative toolbox efficiently. And I mean, you're never going to stop filling it entirely, because you're always going to be perceiving things. But I think that it's so easy to start filtering too much, whether it's reading, you know, books that you already know you're going to like, whether it's only looking at the news channels where you appreciate the angle, whether it's going to only the countries that you've been to before. It doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. But that thing, that's like the enemy of all creativity, that you start filtering yourself too much.
And you mourn the fact that the internet and Instagram and this glut of food bloggers today take all of the surprise out of the dining experience. You know, when I think about it, that's so true. I honestly can't think of the last time that I got a restaurant recommendation from an actual friend, a real human being, someplace I hadn't already heard about in a magazine or a food blog or Instagram, where I really thought I had discovered some hidden gem. It's getting rarer and rarer.
Yeah, it is. You know, it really is. And I think that it's like, at the same time as I love the fact that as a person prone to enjoy research, I really love the fact that I can have access to so much information. Mm-hmm. But I also, as you say, I really mourn this this flow of information that no one really asked for and that no one really needs, but that we still consume.
Right.
And I think that that's the reason. I mean, we've really destroyed one of the most fundamental pleasures of humankind, which is to have your mind thoroughly blown by, you know, sharing too much that no one needs. And I mean, you can still get mind blown, but it's much more difficult now than it was 20 or 30 years ago. Especially with the restaurants, because I thought about that a lot at the end of Favik, and when I already knew that it was going to close and all of those things. And often it felt to me then that when people came in, they had traveled from far away, they paid so much money and they spent such a commitment in time on getting there. And, you know, they had all of these expectations and wanting to have this experience. And a lot of them already knew what every dish was going to look like because they'd seen it on Instagram. A lot of them had already knew what my voice was going to be like because they've heard it on a podcast like this or seen it on television or something. And then like the saddest part of this is that a good quantity of the people that came, they never really had the full experience because they were also so busy documenting this experience that they were supposed to have to share it with others. So they ended up not really being engaged when on site.
Yeah, it occurs to me that having all of this information about restaurants out there on the internet, it must make it a lot easier for other chefs to steal or quote unquote replicate your recipes. Do you ever have to worry about plagiarism?
Yeah, I mean, from my part, I didn't really care about it from the restaurant, like from my own creative process. I don't think that stuff like that should be considered intellectual property like it is when things that have, you know, that cost a lot to develop and have actual value in that sense. Because that's not really the process with food. But I think it's a pity when you take the fast track as a restaurateur or a chef to something that can be perceived by an uninformed crowd as novelty and as your creation, you know, when that's not really the case. And I pity that because of two things. One is that it robs that restaurateur or chef of the pleasure of actually figuring it out themselves, which is integral to wanting to continue, I think. And the second is that all in all, when you combine all of this sort of regurgitation of already used dishes and material, you get less actual new development.
I wonder if also how much of the blame for the lack of innovation among restaurants also lies with the customer, because we create a feedback loop between the diner and the chef, sort of this devil's bargain in which we, the consumers, pay these big bucks to come and eat some signature dish that we read about in a magazine or saw on Instagram. And of course, you know, a restaurant is a business after all. If they want to stay open, they have to deliver on those crowd-pleasing items. So how much of it is our own fault as diners?
I think like quite a bit, actually, for sharing the information the way they do and for also being, but on the other hand, it's like you can't really expect from a diner who should only be going to restaurants to have a good time to also necessarily have the frame of reference to see through like what's, you know, original content, what's been inspired by something or what's truly like straight stolen. I don't think that that's something you can really expect. But I do think that on the other hand, then media has a very big responsibility here that, I mean, some people have taken it seriously and there are great food writers out there and really good reviewers as well. But there's also a lot of people who write about food and they that also have like massive range, but that quite simply don't have the frame of reference to judge whether something is good or bad or new or not. And this has like, this has to be differentiated from the quality of the experience, because you can have a restaurant that's a carbon copy of another restaurant, and you can have a beautiful dining experience as a customer, and there's nothing wrong with that. And the sad thing is just that it propels this sort of momentum where you get less new development all in all. And I think like with the comparison to, for example, people that write and review art, I think is interesting. I don't think that you would have an art reviewer in a major American newspaper reviewing an exhibition by an artist in their hometown, you know, hailing that person to be an absolutely fantastic creator and someone that created something novel. And then someone else looks at the work and realizes that this is actually like a carbon copy of Picasso, where you have people writing food reviews and stories about restaurants that don't even realize that most of this comes from another restaurant that might be as established really as in food as Picasso would have been in art.
We're going to take a quick break and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. Now, in case folks can't tell, you have quite a few opinions about the state of the restaurant business today, some of which I imagine might ruffle a few feathers. Do you think that some of the things that you say in here are controversial?
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there are. Mm-hmm. I think it's impossible to move through life without like rubbing a few mm-hmm. people the wrong way. At least it would be very boring. But, and you know, it's like, I also don't mind being rubbed the wrong way either. I mean, I think that that's like integral that people dare to say what they think and speak up about stuff, because that mm-hmm. actually do, you know, it does bring development that's interesting. Mm-hmm. But I think most of the things that I talk about in the book that from an outsider might seem, you know, as perhaps a bit controversial, is actually in my experience stuff that everyone in hospitality already mm-hmm. know, but that it's also really difficult to talk about when you're still running a restaurant.
I was going to ask you that. I wonder if there are things that you say in this book that you couldn't have said publicly when you were still running a restaurant.
I think I could, but it would have been more difficult. And I would, you know, and it's like, it seems silly now, but it is. You know, the thing is that you're operating a business and, you know, you need it to function in, especially when it's that kind of restaurant that's an experiential restaurant that's highly reliant on people traveling in, which in its turn depends on the restaurant being reported of in a certain way in specific media and so on, then it becomes more difficult because you have to always relate to that. Mm-hmm. And to me, that was one of the things that I really wanted with this book. Like, I didn't want to create like and I don't think that it is either like a sensationalist biography or anything like that, but I wanted to also like speak about a few things that I thought mm-hmm. was, you know, stuff that I didn't feel like I could talk openly about when I still mm-hmm. had the restaurant.
Well, then let's start by asking you about what I think is probably the most sacred institution in the restaurant industry, at least in fine dining, the Michelin Guide. Your restaurant received 2 Michelin stars, but there are those who have problems with the Michelin ranking system and the kind of restaurants and cuisines that it traditionally favors. Can I ask you to weigh in with your own thoughts on the Michelin Guide and whether it's fair?
No, it's not fair. No guides are fair, but that's also not the point of them, right. Actually. And I think that as far as guides and rankings goes, Michelin is actually one of the ones that I favor. Mm-hmm. And for my personal like views on Faviken, Michelin was problematic. Because in the beginning, really? When we started the restaurant, there was no Michelin guide for that part of Sweden. There was never in the cards that there was ever going to be one. And then one day there was suddenly an announcement that there was going to be a Michelin guide. And by then mm-hmm. we were already very established as what we were, which was this experiential restaurant that people traveled to. We were in a specific pricing bracket. There was a lot of things that were already set. And I felt that to me, this is a huge risk because maybe they don't get us. Maybe they, you know, just don't understand what we're doing and they don't feel like it's worth promoting. And then all of a sudden, the story that they're telling is not correlating with the one that we've been telling, and successfully so for many years. Mm-hmm. So I saw that as a risk, yeah, and that was the first thing when they called me and said that, you know, we would like to have you in, or you're going to be, they didn't even say we'd like to have you, they said you're going to be in the Michelin Guide next year, you know, I asked them like, okay, how many stars, and then I thought to myself that okay, it would be great if you go 3 stars straight away, that would be fantastic, then it's not a problem, and that would be, you know, fun for me and the team and so on. But if we get 2 stars, that's okay. If we get 1 star, that's a problem. And then okay. Rebecca Burrows, the director of the Michelin Guide, she said that you'll have 2 stars and, you know, keep going the way you do. We really enjoy what you're doing and so on. And that was my only contact with them. After that, wow. I heard, you know, nothing. I, you know, further to my point, like why I favored them is that I think that they're not ranking restaurants, which I think is silly because there is okay. no such thing as the best restaurant, because that's all dependent on the circumstances on what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. But they're not ranking restaurants, they're awarding them in tiers. Mm-hmm. And that I think is good. And the Michelin Guide is also about sort of some kind of there is like a factor of like reliability around the whole thing, you know, that old fashioned kind of slowness, which I think sure. is really good in this mm-hmm. day and age when there is none of that almost anywhere. Yeah. And then I think there's many other things that they can be critiqued for. There are many restaurants I can definitely say that have both 1 or 2 and 3 stars that shouldn't have them. And there are many, in my opinion, and there are many restaurants that are worthy of stars that doesn't have the right amount. But, you know, as a person that I know very well that used to run a guide, very successfully told me once when I critiqued something that he had done, he said, well, why don't you start your own guide then and see how easy it is?
Now, for a long time, Michelin guide was synonymous with a certain type of restaurant and cuisine, I guess classically defined as haute cuisine. You take issue with that term haute cuisine, or at least its traditional use. When I think of haute cuisine, it brings to mind the stuffy, expensive food, foie gras and truffles and heavy sauces, more in the Escoffier school of cooking. But your idea of haute cuisine has a lot more in common with haute couture. Explain the comparison there.
Yeah, and I think that that's actually a super interesting thing, because I always thought of haute cuisine as like the pinnacle of fine dining, ambitious fine dining. And then one day I had a conversation with a friend and we were talking about these things. And as we were talking, I realized that I'm working at the pinnacle of fine dining, at one of the most highly regarded, most ambitious restaurants in the world. And I just don't feel, like I would never present what we do as haute cuisine. Like I don't feel it. And then I started looking this up and I spoke to this friend and I realized that like the definition is like hasn't changed with the times. And if you look what the haute cuisine is defined as, if you look it up in the thesaurus or online or whatever, you quickly see that it focuses on things like this sort of the place being perceived as fancy, that it's costly, it's the restaurant or a luxury establishment like a hotel. There are many defining factors like that that are just not relevant for the kind of restaurant that Faviken was.
Right.
And at the same time, for various reasons, I also looked up, like you said, the definition of haute couture, the sort of would-be equivalent of the world of fashion, and realized that this is like probably not the way that most high-end ambitious restaurants function, but it is like pretty close to the ideal idea of how a small, independently operated, ambitious, creative restaurant could work, which I thought was cool.
And part of this speaks to our mainstream concept of luxury in dining. We think of it as so rarefied to dine on Kobe beef that's flown in from Japan or foie gras from France. But are we really getting the same quality and flavor as we would if we had ordered those foods in their native countries?
No, you aren't. And that's like the thing, you know. And this is obviously, it's whether you think it's worth it or not, that's a matter of personal preference. Mm-hmm. But no one can say that a slice of Kobe beef is as good in Europe like as it is in Japan. Mm-hmm. Simply because so much will have happened to it. Like, first of all, like the selection process in Japan, for example, you know, it's not like the very, very best Kobe beef is going to ever even leave the country.
Right.
And then after that, you know, whatever you buy, it's been backpacked, it's been transported, it's been handled, like a lot of things has happened to it. So yeah, it might be super tasty, but it's not going to be as good as it is, you know, in its place of origin, and in the place where it also culturally belong, because like the context, I think, is so important for the experience when we eat. And that's like one of these things that I think that we've gotten like a bit wrong when it comes to dining, what is considered luxury and not. And I think that like history will teach us that, like going forward, that maybe we were wrong during this period of time. Mm-hmm. And I haven't actually have an interesting comparison here with sugar. So sugar used to be unattainable. Like the only source of sweetener was like honey that you harvested from a wild beehive and got like 1,000 stings. And it was, you know, very, very precious. And then when people started traveling and you could harvest sugar cane, and like sugar became a little bit more available, it was still like super expensive. It was the stuff that royalty would season their meat with to show that they were rich, you know. And then gradually it became more and more accessible, to a point after the Second World War, after like full industrialization, when sugar is like one of the cheapest calories you can buy. And all of a sudden it's not luxury anymore. It's very accessible. And it's actually the other way around, that it's like anti-luxury today to consume lots of sugar, right? And maybe we'll see the same with produce like this, because, I mean, Kobe beef is considered rare because you couldn't have it in Europe. It's luxury because you couldn't have it. Now you can. Mm-hmm. And it's not like it's going to get less accessible in the future, I think.
Interesting. So one day we may get to the point where truffles and Kobe beef and foie gras are peasant food, huh? I look forward to that day, I have to say.
Might not apply to all of those, but yeah. I think to certain things, like especially with like the stuff that you move around, you know, that's...
Are there certain things that you did import when you were running Fabiken, or what percentage of the ingredients were imported?
The fish came from Norway. Like Fabiken was very close to the Norwegian border, so we were only like 250 kilometers from the ocean, but we were just at the Norwegian border, so we drove across there to get the fish. So that's still like close by, even though it was technically imported from another country. Most of the sugar that we used was refined in Denmark, so another country, even if the beets might have been grown in Sweden to produce them. Mm-hmm. And aside of that, pretty much everything came from Sweden, and most of it came from the region of Jämtland, which is where Fabiken was located.
Mm-hmm. That's impressive. But it also may surprise readers that you, who are now famous for your local seasonal ingredients, speak very frankly about the whole sustainability trend. Is there such a thing as a truly sustainable restaurant, or are they kind of antithetical?
Yeah, I think there are, but I don't think they are the ones that people expect them to be, you know, or the ones that are lauded as sustainable today. If you think about what sustainability truly means, like the essence of the expression of the word, which would be that something that we can do, you know, indefinitely without it having a negative impact on its surroundings. And if you apply that to most restaurants, you pretty quickly realize that that's not really true, even if they are lauded as being sustainable. I mean, with Fabiken, I can tell you that, I mean, I was offered so many sustainability awards during the life of that restaurant that is unbelievable, especially for a restaurant that was entirely unsustainable, but that might have had like that kind of farm cheek little sustainability air around it, because we, you know, work with local produce and had our dining room in a barn. I don't know. But I think that the way we have to look at this is that I don't want to live a life where everything I consume and do is equally sustainable all the time, because it would be incredibly boring to do that. But I also don't want to live a life where we completely ruin our environment. Mm-hmm. And for me, the only solution to that is that we start being very honest about, you know, what is sustainable and what's not, so that we can make informed choices and perhaps treat our, let's say that we have like almost like a sustainability currency, because everyone is used to handling money, right? Because we earn money and then we can spend various amounts on various things, and we can choose to save up to go to a restaurant like Fabiken and whatnot. And I think it should be like a bit the same way, you know, that you can go to an experiential place like Fabiken that's going to cost you many sustainability points, and then you have to save up. Because the truth is, like a place like Fabiken, you know, it's a massively resource intensive operation. Many, many people cooking, producing this experience in a very large building, using lots of energy, lots of commodities, lots of produce to cook only to feed 24 people a day. And obviously, that's not something we can do all of the time, all of us. It's just not right. And I think that that's like the problem where you're claiming that an experiential restaurant is a sustainable option when all they are is perhaps a bit more responsible. Mm-hmm. And it's really, that's an important word, because it's really important to not see this as a way out of having to take responsibility and be better, because we all have to be better at managing our resources, also in restaurants. But part of that is also like letting our customers know the truth.
It just occurred to me that I suspect that many of the Americans listening to this interview, their only reference for a Swedish chef is probably a Muppet character, and their experience with Swedish cuisine may be limited to meatballs in the cafeteria at IKEA. But you were really one of the first chefs to elevate Nordic cuisine and turn Sweden into a foodie destination. I wonder if you could give us kind of a brief introduction to traditional Swedish food and what the main ingredients are, what the ways of cooking are in Sweden and so forth.
Yeah. So I think that if you look at Sweden as a country, it's a fairly diverse. It's a very geographically like elongated from north to south. So it spans over like 2,500 or so kilometers, and it's quite far north. So you will start at the in the south on the Danish border, and you will have a rich agricultural sort of farmland society, like we're talking historically now. And then you will progress further north and you'll come into the inlands, and eventually in the very north, you will be at the tundra. So in this country, you have everything in between. And that means that the food culture is also traditionally very diverse. And in South Sweden, you would see things that are quite similar to Central Europe. There will have been like much more import available, you know, spices, produce bought from other countries, maybe even wine used in food, things like that. Whilst in the very north, I mean, my region, Jämtland, which is like halfway up, I say it's not up north, but it's just halfway up actually, since on the 63rd parallel. Like traditionally, the only crop that will grow there in terms of grains would be barley. So, for example, in my region, there are no traditional breads that are leavened to be loaves. It's only flatbreads. So there's like it's really a country with a huge diversity of foods. And even today, when we don't have to relate to those things, like stuff like, you know, what can grow and cannot grow in a region, we can just import and buy things. Even today, like what used to be necessities, like it influences so much our decisions on what we choose to do today. I think that's like super fascinating, actually.
I remember your section in the book on charcuterie and the fact that now charcuterie is sort of a luxury, but back then, you know, people created charcuterie because they had to get through the winter and have some protein. It was a necessity.
Yeah.
And many of the recipes are included in this book. In fact, you meticulously list every single dish that you ever served at Favikan. Do you have a favorite dish or one that you felt maybe was the perfect representation of what you did at your restaurant?
You know what? And this is so weird because I got this question from someone else like a couple of weeks ago, and I hadn't thought about it before since I closed the restaurant. Like before we closed, I think I would have an answer. But like when I started thinking then, I just realized that I don't feel anything for the dishes anymore. And this like, it surprised me so much, you know, because I'm very proud of what Favikan became, like the evolution from what it was in the beginning to what it was in the end. I'm very, actually also very proud of my evolution as a, like a leader and a manager from beginning to end. And I'm really proud of what the team created and how many people we kind of affected with that. And that I still feel. But when I think of the dishes, like I can't, like for the life of me, think of one that like means more or less. It's like nothing, you know. It's so strange.
Yeah, and it's sort of unusual, this book that you've written, because typically when a famous chef writes a book, it's sort of a way of marketing his restaurant and expanding his quote-unquote brand, so to speak. But if anyone reads your book and wants to visit your restaurant, they're out of luck, because Favikan is no more. You are closed as of last year for good. So why write a book about a restaurant that's no longer open? That's the big question here.
Yeah, yeah, no, it is. And it's like, I didn't intend to write the book at first, actually. It really wasn't. And then I started, I mean, I was offered to do it. I was asked by the publisher first if I wanted to do it. And this is the same publisher that I've written all of my books with. And then I kind of started thinking about it, and I realized like the reasoning why I actually in the end wanted to write the book was partially this thing that we spoke about in the beginning, that I had a few things that I wanted to say. And I started to think more about that, and I realized that, you know, all of the people that have come through the doors of this restaurant, all of the people that have reported on it, produced television shows, written about it, like there's so many accounts on this restaurant out there, and none of them are mine. Yeah. And to me, that felt really important, that I also wanted to say how I thought about this, like how I felt about this restaurant from my perspective. And the only way to do that is if you write the book yourself and you publish it. Because if you ask a journalist to do that, or it's always through someone else's filter, you know? So that was one reason. And then the other reason was that I also started to realize when we kind of announced this, like how much this place had actually meant for so many people. And, you know, part of me, like intellectually, I already knew that we had reached a lot of people, because I mean, I've done so many events and traveled and done lectures and I've sold the books and, you know, done all of these things. But emotionally, I hadn't quite quite understood like the depth of that meaning to so many people out there. I mean, people started like contacting us and like thanking us for what we've done and like what the restaurant had meant for them, and like reading stories about like people really connecting to a place where they've never even been. I just also felt that, you know, there will definitely at least be people who are going to want to read the book and like my take on what this restaurant was.
Now, when you closed Favikan, it was around the same time that you bought an apple orchard with 10,000 trees, which is now, I think, your full-time job. What did your friend say when you said, I'm going to close this hugely successful restaurant and grow apples instead?
Funnily enough, none of them acted with surprise. I don't know what that says. So yeah.
They know you well.
Yeah, no. And it isn't my full-time job as such.
Oh, okay.
And part of me wish that it was, but also part of me is really glad that it isn't. Because I also have another job. I actually work in Copenhagen now. I go there every 2 weeks, and I work with a project that's run by, I don't know if you've heard of them, but it's called MAD Foundation, and was founded by René Redzepi of NOMA 11 years ago. And this foundation has done a lot of things to sort of, the idea of it is to create positive change for the world through hospitality and the hospitality industry. And the project that I'm working on is that we're actually starting a school.
Oh, wow.
Which is, you know, something that I never thought that I was going to do. And this was not something that was decided when I decided to close Favikan, or even, you know, when we announced that we were going to close Favikan. It's something that like grew and happened during that year, the last 6 months of Favikan, and ended up being me getting offered to take on this job and sort of head this project up. And it's actually so I'm working with two jobs that I don't know very much about, because I'm very passionate about the gardening and the growing of apples, and I've read everything that there is to read about growing apples. But it turns out that the theoretical level of knowledge that I have, it doesn't correlate with the practical knowledge of the craft, because I before we bought the place, I'd never pruned an apple tree. So it's like I have a huge learning curve there, and I also have an equally huge learning curve in developing this school and learning from people that are so good and have like such developed methodology to teach people something which I've never had, because I've never gone to university. I've never been good at teaching people anything really, but it's completely fascinating.
But you've probably in a way been mentoring and teaching people for your entire career as a chef, I would imagine. It just almost accidentally it gets absorbed, I suppose.
That's true. But and I've also like seen all of the problems with like hospitality industry and all of the poor ways that the teaching functions there, regardless whether it happens to be on leadership or management or you know, how to treat the environmental impact of a restaurant. Doesn't really matter. Like, I've seen all of the negative aspects of the industry, and I've also been part of many of them myself, you know, having gone from being 24 years old, opening this super ambitious restaurant, being a pretty poor leader at the beginning, not understanding, you know, how to manage a group of people working with you and things like that, to taking way too many years to getting to a point where I got like fairly good at it. And then I think at least ending at the same time as I closed the restaurant, being really good actually at some of that at least. So I think that's like, even though I'm not a teacher as such, I have that perspective, which I think I can, you know, share with people.
Well, before we go, do you think you'll ever open another restaurant? Or maybe I should put it a different way. What would have to happen for it to feel right to open a restaurant again?
Well, I think it's like the basic thing is this. I was never fed up with running restaurants in general. I was just done with that particular project. And I felt like in every fiber of me, I was done with that project, you know? On the other hand, I also don't feel right now a particular desire to open a restaurant. And there are many other things, as the two things I just explained that I'm working on that are like so interesting and so fulfilling to work with right now. So I think that, essentially, if I wake up one morning and I feel the same way as I did for Favikan for so many years, like this sort of real desire to run a place and host guests and do that again, I mean, I'm not going to hesitate a second. I will open a new place then, but I also don't know when that will be and if it ever happens. And I don't have a plan for it either, which is actually really nice because I've had a plan for such a long time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine that can be a relief. Well, I certainly hope that you do get back into the game at some point. In the meantime, it'll be interesting to see what you work on until then. Again, the book is called Favikin, 4,015 Days Beginning to End. Magnus Nilsson, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Magnus Nilsson for coming on the show. Order his book, Favikin, 4,015 Days Beginning to End, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold, and follow him on Twitter at @Favikin. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickassNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.